What's up, family? You are tuned into Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. From KPFA Radio and the Pacifica Network, I'm your host, Kat Brooks.
Following the ousting of the Bashar al-Assad regime, the Syrian people began looking for their disappeared loved ones, including children. Joining us to discuss Syria's missing children is journalist Shane Bauer, best known for his undercover reporting for Mother Jones magazine. He's won several awards, including the Harvard Goldsmith Prize for Investigative Reporting and the National Magazine Award for Best Reporting. He recently published an article for the New York Times called Takeaways from the Times Investigation into Syria's Missing Children. Good morning, Shane.
Hi, good morning.
Thank you so much for joining us. I actually want to start about how this came onto your radar. Like, what led you to this thread of this story?
Well, I've been reporting on Syria for a while. I'm finishing a book about Americans involved in the Syrian war. I lived there, actually, before the war. So when the Bashar al-Assad regime fell, I immediately went to Damascus. I hadn't been there since 2009. And I was there to report on the new government for the Times. But as I was there, I was going through, a bunch of the headquarters of the former secret police were just abandoned. So I sort of was wandering through these places. They all had sort of basement prisons underneath them. And I would see remnants of children, little sandals, clothes with cartoons on them. Really, really disturbing. I mean, these places are just, I reported on prisons in the US, I've around the world, and I've never seen anything like these places. And then I was hearing rumors that that children had been discovered in orphanages, children of political prisoners after the regime fell. So I started sort of looking into it, and I eventually obtained some classified documents from the former regime that sort of led me on this long journey of trying to find their documents, basically showing the secret police putting these children in orphanages, including some run by an Austria-based organization called SOS Children's Villages. So I tracked down some of these families, and ended up becoming an 8-month investigation.
John, can we talk a little bit about some of your methodology? Like, you just talked about tracking down some of the families, but I'm interested in how you went about conducting your investigation, how you were able to access records, how you identified.
Well, in the early initial days after the regime collapsed, there, a lot of people went into these former headquarters of the secret police. And one, a lot of people were looking for records of their own relatives. I mean, there were about 100,000 people disappeared in Syria. This is aside from, the 500,000 killed in the war. The regime used forced disappearance to sort of terrify the population. So people were looking for just records of their own family members to find out what happened to them. And then there were, local journalists and international journalists also sort of seeing what they could find in this sort of window of time where you could access these places before the new government started to sort of close them down. So some people had found a trove of records in a ministry that were, basically orders that were sending particular children from prison to orphanages. And then another source shared with me a huge database that was basically like an internal database used by an agency of the secret police called Air Force Intelligence. And I just spent weeks sort of combing through that. I mean, I started by literally just we're talking an Excel file with over 100,000 entries. And I would just search for the word child to start with, and then pull on threads. And I started finding entries that would have names saying transfer, for example, to SOS Children's Villages or transfer to an orphanage. And I, would then just sort of search the family name and see what I could find and gather this information. And then I found a couple people that whose names were in the documents, and they would sort of send me, I'd ask them if there were others that they knew who got out, and sort of that way start building a sort of group of sources that could describe, one, the place, the prison itself, which I also visited when I was there, and then also, get the chance to interview some of their kids. And the one story that I ended up focusing on I was drawn to it because I saw in these files that one of the family members was a newborn baby they actually took from the hospital. And so I started to sort of search around for this family, and it turned out that they had just moved to the United States. So I ended up meeting them in Massachusetts.
Because of your reporting, we come to care very much about that family. So before we leave, I do want to talk about what their fate looks like in a Trump America where immigrants are being targeted. So I'm just going to pin that. So all right, let's dig in here. Approximately how many children, and I understand from your reporting it's an undercount likely, how many children are estimated to have been disappeared during the Al-Assad regime, and how were these children targeted by the government?
Well, the Syrian Network for Human Rights has put the number at 3,700. These are ones that they've been able to count. At the same time, the new Syrian government has recently, in May, they started a committee that's investigating the disappearance of children. They have so far identified by name, I think, 314. The reason, the way that it was happening was, the regime would essentially, target somebody who they saw as an opponent. So this family in particular, they were from a region outside of Damascus called Eastern Ghouta, which was held by the rebels. And the brother of the mother in the family that I write about, he was working with the Red Crescent. He was a medical worker in rebel-controlled territory. So that was enough for the regime to label him a terrorist. And so they would often, if they couldn't get to a person, he lived under rebel control. This family had left because they didn't want to live in the middle of a war. So the regime would target family members. If they couldn't get to the person they wanted, they would basically just this pull them off the street, and nobody would know where they went or whether they were alive or not. And they used the family as sort of, as a way to punish the target. And then so sometimes when they would grab people off the street, they would have children with them. And so they would end up with these children in prison. And at some point around 2013, a couple years into the war, they decided to place these children in orphanages. And in some cases the parents were tortured to death or executed. We assume now that most of the 100,000 that were disappeared were killed. And so these children then, in some cases, would have their names changed. They would, especially if they were really young, which many of them were, many were infants when they were placed in orphanages. So they would change their identities and essentially cut them off from their original family. So they had no knowledge of, who their parents were, and would not sort of go searching for them. And, despite the fact that so many people were disappeared, the regime was trying to deny that it was doing this and keep it secret. So they, which is probably one motivation, they would sever the ties with the children. So some were then adopted away to families. Others they used as hostages. This was the case with the family that I profile in this piece. So they wanted to get to the brother, the Red Crescent worker, and then that's how it started. And then later they decided they wanted to exchange this family, do a prisoner exchange with the rebels. So for some kids, they would put them and hide them in these orphanages. They would instruct the orphanage in writing, this is in the documents that I acquired, that they're not to reveal their identities or to keep them hidden. So they essentially hide them there, and then they would use them as bargaining chips. And in some cases, they would eventually get exchanged for rebels, which is how this family happened to get out after 3 years.
Let's talk about these orphanages. SOS International, who are they? What role did they play in the disappearing of these children?
SOS says that it's basically the largest organization in the world, running orphanages. They use different terminology, but yeah, essentially largest organization running orphanages worldwide. They operate in over 100 countries. They've been around since just after World War II. They have in the past actually been implicated in the forced disappearance of children in El Salvador. And in Syria, they've operated since the 70s. When the war started, they sort of ramped up their services. They opened some new facilities and would take in children, who were impacted by the war. Some of them lost their parents, some were parents couldn't afford to take care of them. And then the Air Force intelligence and other intelligence agencies started to essentially tell them through a ministry, Ministry of Social Affairs and Labor, they would tell them, we have this, two children, say, we need you to take them and, keep their identity secret. So they did. They would hide these children. I met many families who would actually go to the orphanage, and they would deny that the children were there when they were. They would even, in some cases, refuse to turn over children to their own parents after the parents got released from prison. They would refuse to turn them over unless they had permission from Air Force intelligence. So, this sort of went on and until 2018, when they reduced their programming in Syria and stopped taking these children. Other orphanages continued to the, you know, the they the regime would place children in other orphanages, and SOS, they stopped taking them, but they didn't ever publicize that this was going on. So it sort of continued. And they just sort of, kept it secret.
Shane Bauer, as documents have emerged that clearly show, right, there was communication between the regime and them and that children were placed there, what have they said?
Well, since the regime fell, once some families started to accuse them of helping to disappear their children, they have released some statements. They were very cautious statements. They essentially have said that we initially were saying we got some children that didn't have identification that the regime was giving us. We didn't know where they're from. I found through my reporting very clearly that's not true. They did know. The documents said where they were coming from. So they then, over time, as more sort of started to come out, they did an internal investigation, in which they have said that they had, I think the number is 139 of these children, and they gave, I think, 30 back to their families, and the rest they are not sure where they are. They gave them back to the secret police, and they don't know what happened to
When children disappeared and families figured out, through tenacity of looking for their children, that they may be in an SOS international facility, and they would show up at the facility looking for their kids, what often was the response from the staff there?
Generally, either denial that they have them or we can't give you the kid. And there were even, I mean, there's one instance I found in the records of a man who he also worked for the Red Crescent, which is a branch of the Red Cross, and he found out that his niece and nephews were in SOS. His sister had been imprisoned, so he went there with their grandmother, and he was then arrested and himself disappeared. He was thrown into the same prison as them simply for visiting, for going to SOS. I mean, the organization says that the staff were in a difficult position, which is in many ways true. The regime would likely have punished them if they, didn't sort of follow its orders. But at the same time, the organization did appoint in the middle of this program. They appointed the head of its operations, somebody who is very closely tied to the Assad regime, who is the daughter of an aide of both Bashar al-Assad and his father, Hafez. So they were, not in any way trying to distance themselves from the regime, even while this was going on.
Yeah, and I did like early on in the article, I wrote down the question, who is the staff? And then saw that answered that they were Syrians in Syria. And so there's a little empathy, n not much. I'm clocking time and I really want actually give you some space and time to talk about, and I'm not going to get their last name right, so I'm going to let you do it, the family that you track, Layla and Leon.
Base, yeah.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah. I mean, start, as best as you can, summarizing as you start for us, the mother and their two daughters in a jail, and the words that the mother, imparts with them before they're separated.
Yeah, they I started the piece in the prison there. So they're essentially, detained at a checkpoint, suddenly brought to a secret prison at an airport, and put in an underground prison cell. And the mother is interrogated every day, and the daughter is an 8-year-old, Layla Base, who was 8 at the time, and her daughter Leon, or sorry, her sister Leon, who was 4. They're also interrogated about their uncle, and they stay in this place for a week. This is a place where every night, you hear the sound of torture down the halls. People are tortured to death there. And then after a week, the interrogator tells the mother, "Oh, mama," that the children are going to be taken away, and she may never see them again. They're accusing her of being a terrorist, and so she tells her daughter Layla late at night when she comes back from her interrogation. She says, "They're going to take you away. You and Leon, you need to be Leon's mother, and never forget your name. Never, don't forget your name. Don't forget your mother and father's name. Don't forget your last name. It's the base. And when you get old enough, search for your family." And they're taken away and they're brought to this orphanage. And they are, there are dozens of other children, over 100 in this one facility. There's SOS ran six, at least six orphanages, in around Damascus at the time. And Layla ends up meeting, sort of becoming, she keeps throughout the years that she's there acting as a caretaker, not only for her little sister, but for other children who come in. And she ends up taking care of these kids that she doesn't know herself that they are also children of prisoners. And their mothers are in prison, with her mother. One was a baby named Marwan, and his mother actually got out. She was released by the court and she went to SOS to get her kid, and they told her, "You have to get permission from the intelligence agency." She went to get permission and they threw her right back in prison for years. She was there for another 3 years. So these girls are there. They start using a different last name for them, and it's at one point they even their mom, the women in the prison, organize a protest, which is extremely brave. I mean, I can't understate that, overstate this. I mean, they're in a place where people are constantly tortured to death, and they go on hunger strike. All these women demanding to see their children, and they actually get a visit. So the girls go there, and the youngest girl, and this happened to a lot of mothers where their kids would barely recognize their mothers anymore, and they're taken back away. So after 3 years, they get released in a prisoner exchange. The family is reunited. It takes them a while to sort of come together again as a family after all they've been through, and how young these children were at the time. They eventually go to Turkey, to try to find some sense of security. They don't want it to be anywhere within reach of the Assad regime, and they apply for refuge in the United States, and they get it. So actually, a year ago, they came to the US, to Massachusetts, and they're this new chapter of sort of struggling as immigrants in America, living off SNAP benefits. They lived for months in a hotel, off a freeway in Massachusetts. They're now in Worcester, still trying to find work, trying to learn English. The kids are in school. And it's, ironic that a few months after they got here, one, the regime fell in their own country, and two, Donald Trump was elected, and now they're in a place where people are being disappeared by mass police again, and there's just sort of seem to be going from one difficult rally to the next.
Thank you for segueing there, because that's what I thought as I was reading the end of the article and about the life that they're trying to carve out here in the United States was, damn,
Yeah.
here we go again. Shane
Yeah.
Bauer, thank you so much for your, as usual, brilliant reporting and for taking time to be on our show. I appreciate you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. That's it for this episode, family. You can find more information about topics and guests in this episode's show notes. Law and Disorder is produced at KPFA. That's listener-supported radio on the Pacifica Network. The show is produced by Jesse Strauss and hosted by me, Kat Brooks. Our theme music was composed by Steve Raskin of Fort Knox 5. If you like what you heard, please follow us on social media at Law and Dis, that's D-I-S, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Feel free to holler at us about something you heard or send us a show idea at lawanddisorder@kpfa.org. You can also find our content live at 8 a.m. weekdays on KPFA. That's 94.1 FM in the Bay Area. Our show and all of KPFA's programs are funded exclusively by you, the listener. And if you're in a position to support us, please donate today at kpfa.org. Take care of yourself and take care of each other. We all we got, fam.